knowing that I might be able to jump in that time machine and go back to where I was 5, 6, 7 years ago, it's liberating. I think you used the right word. It's a very liberating experience. And I'm a little afraid, to be honest, of what I'm going to do with that newfound freedom, because I've always been very spontaneous. I've always been kind of an impulsive kid. And this was long before I started the dopamine agonist, so it has nothing to do with my medication. But I'm a little worried about what I'm going to do once if and when the simulation gets turned on and I start reaping all the benefits from this. Because Parkinson's has taken away my freedom. It's taken away my liberty. It's taken away my ability to do the things that I want to do with my day. If suddenly, at the flick of a switch, that gets restored, yeah, I have no idea how I'm going to react. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I hope to be as present in that moment as I possibly can be. But suffice it to say, it's something I'm deeply looking forward to.
Welcome to Stimulating Brains.
Hello and welcome to Stimulating Brains, everyone, once more. This is episode number 12, and I'm really excited about this episode. When I started the podcast and told colleagues about it in the very beginning, a lot of people told me this could also be a great way to integrate the views of patients and other healthcare professionals in this show. And I've been following the work of Benjamin Stecher for quite a while now. He's doing an amazing job in scientific outreach, scientific communication, and he is a patient advocate for Parkinson's disease because he has been diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's disease at the age of 29. Recently, Benjamin co-wrote the book Brain Fables together with the international expert Alberto Espe from Cincinnati, which I can really recommend, and it's a beautiful book combining the views of the medical doctor and the patient in the same book. And I think they created something truly unique with this book. Now, you'll hear some more about what Benjamin's been up to and his life in just a second. But when Benjamin wrote on his blog about his upcoming DBS surgery, I thought to finally reach out to him. And indeed, he was happy to join the show. And he then tweeted about the DBS surgery. And it was quite amazing already to see this procedure that I've been following along from the other side for around 7 years now, from the patient perspective. Now, I told Benjamin to reach out to me whenever he was ready. There was no hurry, of course. And surprisingly, he already reached out 9 days after the surgery. So I'm really happy about this. And the plan is to repeat the conversation one more time once DBS is switched on so that Benjamin can tell us a bit more about how his path continues. So thanks so much for tuning in. And I'm pretty sure you'll enjoy as much as I did the conversation I had with Benjamin Stecher about his very own deep brain stimulation surgery.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Ben. To break the ice, one thing I always ask as a first question is, what do you do in your free time? Like when not thinking, let's say, about Parkinson's disease and not writing books. I read that you like the German TV series Dark, and I'm a big fan myself. That's cool. I also saw something about cryptocurrency on your website. So what are your hobbies?
I love the show Dark. It's probably the biggest of all everything I've watched over the past couple years. No story has captivated me as much as that show. It was really a unique way of telling the story. I loved it. The devices used, I loved everything about it. When I'm not thinking about Parkinson's or I'm not thinking about advocacy or I'm not writing, I like to play and watch basketball. I'm a big fan of the NBA. I like to swim. Well, I liked to swim, I guess. It might be a while before I can do that now, but you have to make some sacrifices along the way.
Sure.
And I like to play golf. I like to be outside. I like to play tennis as well. I like to be active. I like to try to run around as much as I can. And other than that, I like to read. I have a pretty wide variety of interests in what I read, a pretty eclectic mix there. And travel That's probably my biggest drug, other than the drugs that I take, is getting out and seeing the world.
Great. Sounds amazing. So lots of things to do. Now, diving into it, so I think we are around the same age, the two of us. But in 2013, you were then 29 years old. Life took a different turn for you. Back then, you worked on a management position in Shanghai, as I've read, and were then diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's disease. Can you talk a bit about that period of your life?
Sure. So at the time, I was riding pretty high. I was doing really well in Shanghai, managing that company that you mentioned. I was also traveling all around China, getting to see the people, getting to see my clients all over the place. I was helping expand to offices in Hong Kong and to Shenzhen and to other cities in the, around the eastern coast of China. And then I got hit with that diagnosis. Now, at first, it didn't concern me very much, to be honest, because I didn't understand what this disease was. I had no reference points other than Muhammad Ali and Michael J. Fox. And at the time, my symptoms weren't that bad either. So I thought, okay, if this is what Parkinson's disease is, then I can manage with this. It's not that bad. But then slowly I started to learn a little bit more. I started to delve into the research. I started to ask a lot of questions. I started to read as much as I could about this disease. And for lack of a better term, I started to realize how much trouble I was in. So I decided when I was 32 to pack up my things in Shanghai and move back to Canada to tackle this thing full time. And since then, I've been traveling around the world, visiting as many centers as I could. I've probably visited over 100 different biotech or academic centers at this point, just trying to figure out what the latest and greatest in this disease is and what the future is going to look like in terms of new therapies in the pipeline.
Great. I found this nice brief bio of yours on the website of the Journal of Parkinson's Disease, which even brings us a bit beyond that. It said Benjamin Stecher was born in Nairobi, Kenya, as an Israeli to Jewish parents from Poland, but grew up just outside Toronto, Canada. He studied history and philosophy at the University of Guelph, but as soon as he got his BA, he took off and went to live and work as a teacher in South Korea for nearly 3 years while traveling the world. He moved to Shanghai, China at 26, spending 1 year at Jiao Tong University in a Chinese language program before being hired by Chinese education company Sanli. That's what we talked about. He rose quickly and became managing partner, where his duties included, and so on and so forth. So it seems like you've seen a lot of the world already. Now you travel the world to see the institutes of Parkinson's disease. I wanted to ask, do you miss traveling? But it seems like you travel a lot nonetheless. That's great.
Yeah, I do miss traveling. In this past year and a half, I've been cooped up because of the pandemic. It's been difficult. It's probably the longest I've ever spent in one place in my entire life. Yeah, I miss it dearly. I can't wait to go out and see the world again. And I hope that, it can open up as soon as possible.
And you took on, as you mentioned, the mission to find out as much about PD than you could. You also co-founded the Parkinson's Research Advocacy Group and are a patient advisor to the World Parkinson's Congress. You not only visited so many institutes, but on your website, we can see that you also interviewed over 80 world experts in the field to date. And many of these interviews you make openly available on your website, the Tomorrow Edition, to which, of course, I'll link in the show notes. So you've interviewed experts, but today you are the expert because I'm interviewing you. And you are one of us to have actually witnessed Parkinson's disease as close as very few of us as a patient. Actually experiencing bradykinesia, tremor, and rigidity in embodied form. I'm now making this sound a bit as it was a good thing and must emphasize that, of course, it's not. But still, your insights are unique when seen from a purely scientific perspective. So would you be able to share some of them with us? How did being a patient inform your research on the topic?
Yeah, so it's hard because you walk a tightrope as a patient, especially as a patient advocate or patient researcher. You're constantly balancing what you're reading about with what you're experiencing. And it's kind of a difficult mind game to play because you want to make sure that you're not biased by your own experience so you can look at what you're studying objectively. And that's hard because I mean, you see the word tremor, you see the word bradykinesia, and it has a different connotation in me than it would in somebody who doesn't have this disease. And that's just a natural byproduct, I think, of being human. I have a very different relationship with those words than a researcher would. I also understand that I'm biased. And this is something that's hard as a patient advocate, and something that a lot of difficulty that a lot of patient advocates face is making sure that they don't see themselves in the disease too much. So if you're going to be advocating for a disease, especially one as heterogeneous as Parkinson's, you have to remember that each person who has this disease experiences it in a very different way. You mentioned the World Parkinson's Congress. I went to the first one in Portland. My first experience was in Portland in 2016. There were at least 1,000 patients in attendance. And you walk the halls of that giant conference center, and you look at them, and you see basically 1,000 different diseases. Mm-hmm. I don't think any two patients at that conference presented their symptoms in exactly the same way. And that makes this disease, one, a fascinating peculiarity for researchers and for me as well. And two, it makes it extremely difficult to study because we have this label that we call Parkinson's and we assign it to everybody who has this disease. But the reality is that there's, to quote Bass Bloom, there's 7 million different people living with Parkinson's, living with the label called Parkinson's disease. Unfortunately, that might mean there's 7 million different forms of this disease that we might have to tackle.
Yeah, that's a great quote. And it's a perfect setup for the next question. You co-wrote a book with Alberto Espay, who's of course an internationally known Parkinson's disease expert in Cincinnati. And the book is called Brain Fables, and it won the Prose Award of the Association of American Publishers in the category Neuroscience this year. Congratulations for that. Well, let's dive into maybe very briefly what the book is about as a summary, because I think that's exactly what you just talked about.
Yeah, it's really the idea, and this, to quote Alberto at this point, we've learned a lot about Parkinson's disease, but we know next to nothing about any individual living with Parkinson's disease. And I see this all the time on the various committees and various panels that I'm part of. Everyone talks about Parkinson's, especially researchers, in these generic terms. They paint with a very wide brush. And yet, when you drill down into the individuals that live with this disease, like I said before, you see so many different flavors, so many different spices, so many different forms of this disease. Even the tremor that I experience.
Yeah.
I don't think other patients experience it exactly the same way that I experience, because mine travels from my, right now you can't see it, but it's in my left foot and it's in my right hand. I don't know anyone who has quite that same, like, that it's localized in those exact same ways. And that individual nature of this disease makes any study of this very difficult and very challenging. But as the book illustrates, that's the path we need to be walking. That's where we need to be heading if we're going to ever properly manage and tackle this disease. We need therapies and interventions that are not one size fits all.
Yeah.
They can each be tailored to each individual's needs at any given moment in any given time, which is why, and I'm assuming we're going to talk about this at some point, but jumping ahead a little bit, which is why I'm so excited about this new thing I have in my brain.
Yes, that's the main topic, definitely. Very briefly, you also, like, especially I think in the beginning of the book, you wrote some chapters about the patient perspective. And there you wrote, for example, I soon realized I had more resources at my disposal than any king or emperor had ever dreamt of. How was it like to be able to speak with experts such as John Hardy, Alfonso Fasano, Anatole Kreitzer, Bass Bloom, Tony Lang, but also in the general neuroscience experts such as Eric Kandel or Christoph Koch? How is it to have Google and PubMed to find out as many things as you could imagine about the brain and Parkinson's disease?
Yeah, I often think of myself as being very fortunate and very lucky. Very lucky that I'm growing up where I'm growing up, here in Toronto, and I have access to the great surgeons and the great team here in Toronto.
Yeah.
And very lucky to be living in the time that I'm living in. If I had been born in any other century, or even in any other decade, really, in the past, I would not have had the ability to access all of these great minds and all of these great institutions and all of this great learning that I have today. And that really has it's allowed me, while this disease sucks and nobody would ever want it, it gives some credence to the often heard quote, now is the best time in history to live with Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. And that's very much true. And that makes me feel very fortunate and very grateful to be alive when and where I am.
Great. I think you wrote Parkinson sucks, but I wouldn't trade these last few years for anything. Is that still true?
Yes, it is. It's even more true now after the surgery, to be honest. It's given me insights into my own brain and to the human mind. I think that very few people can access, that very few people will ever get to. I mean,
great.
How many people have heard the sound of their own subthalamic nucleus?
Yes, that's true. I even wanted to ask you that. How was that feeling like to listen to that?
It was surreal. It's something that words probably can't properly describe. To hear that static is probably the wrong word, but like it does sound like a Geiger counter of sorts. But yeah, it was just surreal. It was surreal to feel the whole thing. It was surreal from every moment. I remember very vividly every single detail of those 3 hours. They're indelibly etched in my brain. I hope soon to be able to write about everything so that I can get everything down on paper.
Yeah. Before we get into that, I think maybe before the surgery, regarding therapeutic options that are out there, you wrote in the book, I have swallowed tablets of bear bile, drank elixirs containing seal penis, had bags of glutathione dripped into my veins, and applied topical creams made from bird saliva. Moreover, you considered bee sting therapy, ice water immersion, conscious walking, electric stimulation mats, high-dose thiamine injections, hypnosis, vagal nerve vibration therapy, antifungal creams, and many more. So I work in DBS and Parkinson's disease, but I didn't even know these things existed. How is it possible to navigate between truth and myth as a patient?
So you hit on what is exactly the main challenge that I faced and the big reason why I wrote this book. The original title was Brain Fictions, actually, but because of our editor thought that having that would conflict with the nonfiction genre of writing. But anyways, that right there is the key challenge to having this disease for me anyways. Knowing what to believe and who to believe. That has been my great struggle throughout this journey, is just knowing who I can trust and knowing what kind of information is good information, what kind of information is bad information. I've relied a lot on my background in philosophy to help me navigate that and to help me get to a point where I feel like I'm fairly confident being able to say who and why, or what are the reasons for why I trust this source over that source, or why I have more faith in this hypothesis over that hypothesis. But really, it's been bred out of trial and error. I've tried so many things along the way. I've tried so many different kinds of therapies. At the beginning, I was very naive about everything. I thought, I believed that a lot of these therapies would work for me. And that belief is powerful in and of itself. Obviously, we know a lot about the placebo effect and everything that the placebo effect can do for a person. But belief is a powerful thing. If you believe something works, it has a stranglehold over you in some sense. And I see this time and time again in the news and time and time again in the patient advocacy groups that I'm a part of. That belief that something works is such a powerful magnet. It's such a powerful motivator. It's such a powerful way of getting people to do something. And yet we have to be grounded in reality. And knowing the difference between what is real and what is not real is the real challenge that of our times, I think. We're inundated with so much information these days. There's so much resources out there. If I do a search for Parkinson's disease therapies, I can come up with, there's probably a billion different hits that will come about. Knowing how to navigate all of that, knowing how to discern what is worth pursuing and what is not worth pursuing is the greatest challenge that I face. It's the greatest challenge I feel like we face going forward in terms of properly dealing with this. And it's something that I continue to think about. Even now, after having DBS, I still wonder if I made the right decision. There's so many different options I could have pursued. There's so many different avenues I could have explored. There's so many different therapies that sound promising. Knowing trying to hone in on which one is the right one for you as an individual is a very difficult decision. And I think patients are in many ways left to their own devices to sort that out. There's no guidebook for what's best for you as an individual. Life doesn't come with a manual. You have to figure out the tools needed to be able to discern for yourself along the way what is the right path to take and what is the wrong path to take.
How did you decide to do DBS? You wrote a blog post about the pros and cons of DBS, but also cell replacement therapy, focused ultrasound, and gene therapy. Why DBS in the end?
For a number of reasons. One, I had access to a great number of experts here at the Toronto Western Hospital who have made a living or who have made a career out of advancing and pursuing DBS therapies. So that was one key factor, that I had the expertise in my corner. And also, in some ways, I was driven by fate as well. So about 3 or 4 years ago, I was sitting in Hadassah Medical Center. Hadassah is a medical center in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I was in Haggai Bergman's office. I spent with him about 4 hours, one-on-one. He gave me like a private lecture for about 4 hours on closed-loop deep brain stimulation therapy.
Nice.
I had no idea at the time that he was basically painting my future. He was painting the future that I was going to experience. He illustrated, I didn't understand everything he said, and to date I don't remember everything that he said, but I was profoundly impacted by those few hours, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I now know that that future that he was envisioning was the right one for me. It also coalesced around another person, which was Alfonso Fasano. About 5 years ago, 5 years ago when I came back from China to pursue this full time, I started to look around at the different neurologists in Toronto that I had access to. I sent a bunch of emails to them asking them questions. A couple people responded, but one person really took a strong interest in my case, and that was Alfonso. I then went to his office, I sat with him, and we started to discuss this disease and my potential future therapies. And I think he could see how curious I was. He could see the passion I had in me to learn as much as possible. And at the time, I was asking some very, very, very simple, very basic questions. What is an axon? What is dopamine? What are neurotransmitters? I was amazed by how patient, this is both Haggai and Alfonso, I was really amazed, and this is something I would love, I hope all scientists realize the power that they have in this sense. I was taken aback and I was amazed by how much time they spent just explaining those basic concepts to me. Really spending the time to allow another person to understand what you're working on, especially something that's so personal to them. It was a life changer for me. It was a life changer in many different ways, but all of those things kind of came together and coalesced to bring me to where I am today. All those happenstance occurrences. I've never actually spoken with Haggai Bergman since then, but I remember that those 3 hours that I spent with him very clear, 4 hours that I spent with him very, very, very clearly. It was a remarkable journey that he took me on. To make a long story short, that was another reason why I chose DBS. And then on top of it, the other therapies that were options for me, stem cell therapy, gene therapy, focused ultrasound, and another one would have been subcutaneous levodopa pumps. None of them offered none of them had the same kind of track record as DBS did. So DBS obviously has 20 plus years of use in humans. We have over, by last count I saw, over 150,000 people have had deep brain stimulation surgery. We've seen its successes. We know pretty well what it can do and what it can't do. For some of these other therapies, we're much more in the dark. We don't have the same depth of history that we can draw upon.
Makes sense.
And then the final thing was just talking to patients who have gone through this before. DBS is a very scary thing. It's a very traumatic thing to go through, especially the way I chose to do it, which was to be awake through the whole process. But in speaking to the people that had gone through before me, I was very reassured by how... It's hard to say because you don't want to put the cart before the horse. I'm only a week and a half out of the surgery myself. I don't know what kind of benefit I'm going to experience. I don't know how successful this will be for me. But if I can get even half of the benefit that some of the other patients have gotten before me and some of the what we think it might do for me, then I'll be happy. Especially because, one other factor, my symptomology in particular, and my relatively young age, I think make me a perfect candidate for DBS.
That is true, yeah. Now, let's talk about it. I mean, we already talked about DBS now, but I wanted to briefly formally say that one more time. 9 days ago, you underwent DBS surgery to the subthalamic nucleus at the Toronto Western Hospital. So it's amazing that you do this right now with me. Thank you so much one more time. How do you feel?
I don't feel like somebody who's had brain surgery 9 days ago. I'll say that to begin with. I feel surprisingly good. Even though it looks a little bit horrific, there's a lot of crusted blood that I'm not allowed to touch. I feel very good. I feel almost as good as I did prior to the surgery, I would say, at this point.
How was the surgery itself? You already mentioned it was awake. So depending on the hospital, people can choose, I guess, awake versus a sleep surgery or even hybrid forms. So this involves mounting a stereotactic frame on your skull, drilling burr holes into your skull while you're awake, and then recording brain activity from microelectrodes as well as test stimulations at the target site. How was that?
Yeah, that's a big question. It's unfortunately not something I can wrap up in a few words. Like I said before, those 3 or 4 hours that I spent in the OR, they're indelibly etched in my brain. I remember so many details from that surgery, so many details from that day. It's hard to put it all into words. But I guess to begin with, I'll start by saying, going into the surgery, I felt very ready. I felt very at peace with the decision I made. I felt very good about the things going forward. And this is something I wanted to emphasize quite a bit. It's very hard to prepare somebody to go through something like this. It's a very, like I said, a very traumatic thing to experience. In the 9 days since, I've been speaking to a couple patients who are scheduled to get DBS in the coming days, months, and weeks. Some of them I see a lot of fear, a lot of apprehension about what they're about to experience. And I think rightfully so. Getting holes drilled in your brain is not a minor thing. It's something that will change your life forever, for good or for bad. Whatever happens, I know for myself, whatever happens going forward, my life won't be the same. I hope for the better. I hope I'll get that maximum benefit from all this, everything that I went through, but you never know what's going to happen. You never know what the future is going to hold. So thinking back to that day, what it was like, I don't know. I don't want to describe it as a religious experience, but in some ways it bears some similarities.
Maybe mystical.
It is very mystical. I remember, for example, probably the most traumatic event of the whole day, probably the most traumatic thing I went through. So the most painful part was actually just the freezing of the scalp. When they freeze all of the different things. Yeah, they stick like at least a dozen needles in you just to freeze all of the areas around the skin so you don't feel anything. After that point, you're not in pain at all anymore. So there's no pain experienced after that freezing point. But you know everything that's happening. You feel everything that's happening. And me being uber curious, I asked my neurosurgeon to explain everything that he was doing and to teach me as much as he could along the way. And there was a couple times where he had to tell me to shut up, to stop talking, to stop asking questions because they needed to... They need to focus and they need to concentrate, rightfully so. But I was there and present throughout the whole thing. I guess the most shocking part of the whole thing was the drilling of the burr holes through the skull. It was the loudest sound I've ever experienced. It was the world was shaking all around me. Like the entire universe felt like it was shaking. It was something, yeah, getting holes drilled through your skull.
The acoustic transmission is via the bones as well, right? So that's, I guess, it's loud itself, but it's much louder for you even more, yeah.
Every little scrape, every little, even though it kind of goes by in an instant, it goes by very relatively quickly, and again, there's no pain involved at all. That sound is something I'll never forget. That sound is something I'll never be able to get out of my head. And then, again, it's so hard to put everything into a few words or a few sentences. There's just moments that stick out. There's moments that give me pause. It's something I'm still reflecting on, to be honest. It's something I probably haven't completely absorbed the whole experience myself yet. It's something I need to reflect on more. It's something I'm definitely going to be writing about in the future. But it was unique. It was traumatic. It made me feel alive. It was horrible in some points. It was very uncomfortable. But I'm oddly happy that I went through it.
What else happened during surgery? Was there some research involved or recordings or stimulations?
Yes. So during the surgery itself, I had a microelectrode recording of my subthalamic nucleus. And that was wild itself, to hear the sound of the microphone dropping through the different layers of the cortex and then going down into the basal ganglia. And then that sound that you get when you hit that sweet spot of the STN and that pitch perfect noise that it makes once it hits that sweet spot was quite remarkable just to hear that sound emitting from your own brain. And knowing that electrical activity that's responsible for everything I touch and feel and experience in the world is remarkable in and of itself. Again, a lot of these things, I'm finding it hard to find the words, to be honest.
It's the brain listening to itself, right? It's even for us outsiders standing by, each time I've done this since 7 years at least, to attend surgeries, and it's still remarkable to listen to the live cells firing of a living human brain. But if it's your own brain, I guess that's a whole different story.
It is. It is a whole different story. I remember thinking very vividly at that time. So I was tapping my fingers together. I was trying to manipulate the sound. I was trying to manipulate what was happening. I don't know if I was successful in being able to do so in real time. But that idea, that thought, that electrical current that gave rise to that noise that allowed me to do this was... Yeah, trying to tweak that in real time was a pretty crazy experience. And then on top of that, then once the simulation was turned on, so once I started to feel some of the symptomatic benefit, that's when I knew that, again, I don't know how to put this into words exactly, but so right now I'm off. This is what you're seeing in the camera. This is what I experience when I'm off. I'm stiff. I have a tremor. It's hard for me to move about properly. When he turned on the simulation and suddenly I could move my wrist and my hand and my arms, it was like taking a time machine back in time to when I was 7 years ago, soon after my diagnosis, when I felt good. I didn't need any medication really at the time. Jumping back in time like that, just by that stimulating that part of my brain, again, it's hard to put into words what...
Is it liberating? I could imagine that, because you suddenly are able to move more again.
Liberating is a good way of putting it, I would say. I would say Parkinson's, in a lot of ways, what it does is it shackles you. It binds you to not only the spaces around you, but to the moments that you experience. I remember, the next day afterwards, because there's that micro lesion effect that takes hold and you feel the benefit for prolonged afterwards. The entire next day, I was euphoric. I felt complete relief and complete happiness simply because I was able to move about fairly comfortably in the world. I no longer felt those. It was almost like being freed from jail. You feel just that release, that easing of the tension and that all the anxiety, all the stress of having this disease, of having to manage it day in, day out. it kind of dissipates. It all goes away. Because one thing about Parkinson's, it's a very stressful way to live a life, simply because everything is so unpredictable. You can't predict when you're going to be on, when you're going to be off, when you're going to be dyskinetic, when you're going to be bradykinetic, when you're going to feel a tremor, when you're going to feel dystonia. It's very difficult to plan your days. Knowing now that it's possible that I might be able to, once the programming begins and once I find the right settings for myself, knowing that I might be able to jump in that time machine and go back to where I was 5, 6, 7 years ago, it's liberating. I think you used the right word. It's a very liberating experience. And I'm a little afraid, to be honest, of what I'm going to do with that newfound freedom, because I've always been very spontaneous. I've always been kind of an impulsive kid. And this was long before I started the dopamine agonist, so it has nothing to do with my medication. But I'm a little worried about what I'm going to do once if and when the simulation gets turned on and it has, and I start reaping all the benefits from this, because Parkinson's has taken away my freedom. It's taken away my liberty. It's taken away my ability to do the things that I want to do with my day. If suddenly, at the flick of a switch, that gets restored, I have no idea how I'm going to react. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I hope to be as present in that moment as I possibly can be. But suffice it to say, it's something I'm deeply looking forward to.
Sounds great. From the outside, we often see motor first, right? And that's the main thing we often see, and that is maybe because why Parkinson's disease has been classified as a motor disease. Would you think it was also to some degree liberating in terms of thoughts? So the inner world, was that also shackled by the disease, or is that wrong to assume?
Yes, even in speaking with you now, I can't communicate as clearly as I'd like to. I can't, because part of my attention is on my foot that has a tremor in it right now. Part of my attention is on my hands that can't move as fluidly as they used to. Part of your cognition is taken up by this disease, whether it's in the background or not, whether you're focusing on a symptom or not, whether you're trying to mitigate something. You're always partially distracted by the disease itself, as long as you feel the imbalances and the lack of coordination and the lack of fluid movements that this disease brings about. I look forward to not having to spending a day at some point in the near future where I don't think about the word Parkinson's, or I don't think about this disease. I think that's what I'm most looking forward to than anything else. Having my mind free of these symptoms that I experience, I think that will be the greatest gift that I could possibly get.
I just took a walk with Christos Ganos. He's also in Berlin. I don't know. You probably know him as well. He's a movement disorders specialist at Charity. And I told him, what should I ask Ben Stecher? And he came up with the question, do you think Parkinson's disease is a movement disorder?
No. I would classify it as a communication disorder. Communication, obviously, between the cells in your brain. But more to the point, it's a break in the circuitry. It's dysfunction of those neural pathways, of those electrical currents that drive your ambitions, that drive your desires, that drive your motivations, that drive your hunger, that drive your feeling of satiation. To call it a movement disorder does not do justice to everything that it does and everything that it is. It puts it into a category, and it's in some ways it's a helpful category, but it doesn't come close to describing the totality of what this disease is. So yes, Christoph was bang on in his suspicion. I would not classify it as movement disorder.
Going back to the surgery, a day after you tweeted that you experienced your first day in 5 years on which you did not experience an off phase. You already briefly touched on that, but can you maybe tell listeners some more what that means?
Sure. So Parkinson's for me anyways, the way I experience Parkinson's is characterized by these fluctuating on-off symptoms that I experience throughout the day. I basically ride almost a sine wave of on-off. So I take my first pill at about 7:38 in the morning. I turn on, which is usually a dyskinetic time for me. I usually experience quite a bit of dyskinesia. That lasts for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Then I slowly drift off where the medication stops working properly. And then I have to take it again to get back on. So that sine wave, that fluctuating curve, is the rhythm of Parkinson's disease for a lot of people. At least that's what it was for me. That day afterwards, that sine wave was flat. I had no fluctuations in my symptoms for that one day. That, coming back to what I said before, that ability to predict what's going to happen next, that ability, that freedom from that pattern of existence that I lived before and that I'm back in now, that was a joy to experience and a joy to go through. I would do it all again just to live that day.
Wow, that sounds great. And maybe we should mention briefly that I guess your system is currently switched off, so that is often referred to as the stun effect or honeymoon phase. So we can expect similar improvements later, but maybe not now. So it's normal. I just wanted to mention it's normal that you're worse now. And I know you know that, but maybe the listeners don't. So I wanted to briefly mention it.
Yeah, yeah. And honeymoon is a good term for it, I think, as well. Because it does feel like you're free from everything that came before it.
Super. Day two after surgery was worse. Can you explain why?
Well, for one, I had the battery inserted and the wires tunneled through the back of me. That was much more painful to wake up to. It's a much more painful procedure. And it creates a lot more damage, I think, along the way as well. Also, it's much more restricting in your movement. So for at least the next 3 or 4 days after that second surgery, I couldn't move my right arm, or at least I couldn't move it without feeling that sharp pain in my chest. Anything and everything that made me stretch or pull on those muscles around my chest, anything and everything that had any effect on the muscles there was extremely painful. I felt those sharp tinges of pain immediately. Also, the wiring, it still bothers me to this day. It's actually probably my biggest complaint right now. Is you feel the tunneling, you feel the scar tissue forming, and you feel just a lack of flexibility in your neck. I think it's something I'm still grappling with, but I can feel it dissipating over time. It's getting easier and easier and easier every day. But yeah, that second surgery is much more painful, and I'm hoping, and from what I gathered, this is the way we're heading, that we figure out a way to do this again, to do this kind of surgery without that second stage. I don't know if it means putting the battery in the cap of the electrode or whatever the technology might be needed to make that happen. If the surgery was just the brain surgery, as weird as it might be to say, this would be so much simpler for the patient, so much easier on the patients.
It's really good to know, because you would think the opposite, right? To ask again, it was not the second surgery itself, but waking up to it, right? Is that correct? So you were asleep for that one.
Yeah, I was asleep for that one. And it was the pain of the healing process that comes afterward.
You participate in a trial of adaptive DBS and also wrote a blog post about that, what that means. Could you let us know?
So there's not a whole lot I can say at the moment. Simply because we haven't started the trial. There's still a lot of things that need to be worked out, so I can't get too into it.
I mean, just the general concept of adaptive DBS.
Yeah, so this goes back to my discussion with Chagai Bergman. That idea of closing the loop, that idea of having that feedback system in place so that you can, so that not only is your brain responding to this new stimulation inside of it, but the stimulant itself is responding to what the brain is doing. That is a very attractive notion to me. I think that is the key to really delivering personalized care for people with Parkinson's disease. Because throughout the day, everything changes constantly. If I'm running, if I'm eating, if I'm sleeping, if I'm sitting at a computer typing, I have different needs at any of those moments. And I need something that can adapt to each of those given times. I need something that can change over time, not only throughout the day as I experience different things, but as my disease progresses over time as well. I'm sure more things will come up that I need to address. It's imperative that these devices are able to change over time. Even better if they're able to learn and adapt, as the trial states, or as this new technology promises. Simply because, it has to be flexible enough to. Life is not static. Life is not an end process of itself. Life is a continuum. And if you don't have something that can adapt on that continuum, that can ride those fluctuations with you, then it will inevitably become more and more obsolete the longer time goes on.
I totally agree. And I mean, just as general remark or background information for listeners, so the normal continuous DBS would just be on all the time, wouldn't respond at all to your brain, right? But what you're now trying, or the team is now trying in Toronto, would be to sense at the same time, so sense the brain signals and then respond to that. So, of course, as you mentioned, this could mean that when you move, it stimulates differently than maybe when you don't move or so.
Yes, exactly. Hopefully it'll learn my patterns and learn how to adapt to things over time. But also I'm wondering, and this is I have a question for you, if you don't mind.
Sure, of course.
How it works, how DBS works. Now, obviously, this is something that I don't think anybody can really pinpoint. No one knows exactly how it works. But the idea that the brain is going to be... So right now I have these electrodes freshly implanted in my brain. And my brain is trying to figure out what to do with this new foreign thing in its environment. And I'm sure there's all sorts of glial cells that are responding and forming scar tissue. But once the device gets turned on and the stimulation starts, it's going to need to adapt to that new stimulant. However, if the stimulation itself is adapting as the brain is adapting, closing that loop, closing that feedback mechanism, I'm assuming that they've figured out how to do this, but I don't know for myself how that works. Do you have any insight that you might be able to share with me?
I'm happy to share everything I think, but it's so funny. I just want to mention that my next question would have been, how does it feel to undergo a procedure of which we cannot fully tell how it works, but only that it works, right? So I think in your book, you also said, quoted George Church, who's a geneticist at Harvard, who said, we developed effective smallpox prevention back when we had close to zero understanding of virology and immunology. So essentially, I wanted to ask you the same question. My two cents on it would be a few things. So first of all, I think we can only, with DBS, we can only, we cannot inject meaningful information currently to the brain. And with meaningful information, I mean information that could substitute something that's not there anymore, that's physiological, you know, some complex, as you say, communication in the brain. We cannot inject that, not yet. People are working on these things, but that's far ahead in the future. So what we can do, I believe, is rather to disrupt information flow. And of course, we don't want to disrupt the good information flow, but the pathological one, right? So the information flow that has gone haywire to some degree. And that might be one reason why, you know, both lesioning to the subthalamic nucleus and DBS works, why also it seems to work in quite a few diseases, right? It does work in stonia, even the STN. It's not that popular, but it would work. And then in Tourette's disease, even an OCD, slightly different target. But it seems to me like there needs to first be a pathological signal somewhere that we could then modulate with DBS or tone down. And then maybe the physiological information is free to flow again, right? So maybe we reduce bandwidth. We reduce the pathological signal that is taking up all the bandwidth, and that it makes it possible for the real information or the good information to flow again. And that would have a few implications. For example, I would predict that if we would stick an electrode into my brain, not much would happen. And I would probably not develop dyskinesia, right? So again, I think something would happen, of course, but, you know, not dyskinesia probably, because we would need the pathological signal first, which fortunately for me is not there. And I guess second part of your question would be with the adaptive DBS, and I guess this is a trial. I have no information, of course, of what exactly is happening, but in the adaptive DBS trials that have been there so far, people have looked at the beta power often. That's one marker, and that is over 10 years described really beautiful marker that really codes, it seems, for symptom severity, especially bradykinesia. So not tremor, but bradykinesia. So across patients, you can correlate how much beta power with how much symptoms, how many symptoms, and then also in single patients, it correlates, you know, it predicts, it seems to code for how much bradykinesia is there. So now, of course, in adaptive DBS, we can measure that and say each time it hits a threshold, we can tone it down again. We can turn on DBS and disrupt that pathological synchronized information flow. So that's my two cents. I must say, though, I'm in the imaging world in DBS, in Parkinson's, so I'm not an electrophysiologist, and this is just how I understand and treat the disease currently in my brain. So I think maybe just to finish this, the third part of your question was, you know, if that would now adapt to each other, and that's a great question. You know, if you move, beta also goes down. So then how does the device know you move and so on? And I think that's really ongoing science here, where people start using machine learning and so on to better decode what really is happening in the brain. So use a more complex marker than just beta power. And I assume you now have a device where you will always, or you could always get the software upgrades to, let's say, implement the newest technology in this. So that could be great.
Yeah, and coming back to your previous question about why I chose to do this, a small part of it was also just the opportunity to take part in this trial. I'm a natural-born curious person, and the opportunity to play a role in helping us advance our understanding of ourselves and to understand our understanding of this disease was very attractive to me. I also kind of think somewhat egotistically that I think I'm a good person to test this on, not only because of my symptoms and my age, but because I have that curious nature in me. I'm going to be tweaking things regularly as we go. And I think it makes for interesting experiments. There's so many experiments I want to do. There's so many little things I want to try after this gets turned on and after we start programming and fiddling with the devices. I'm excited just to be a living, breathing experiment onto the world.
Yeah, and I guess you're right that from a scientific perspective, you are a perfect patient. That's true, right? You're young. You can maybe take part in experiments that take a bit longer and so on. And you're also very sharp and so on. So that is true. And in a similar fashion, it's really so special and unique to interview you because of the many, not only because you're young, but also because of the many insights you have acquired over the years. You know, so you have so much interest in the disease and now you experience it. So that makes it such a unique and very invaluable experience to interview you. So I wanted to touch upon a few more smaller topics before I let you go for now. Your Twitter bio reads, consultant and advocate in biotech, pharma and academia, pushing for what is needed to properly treat and care for people with neurodegenerative diseases. You also work and identify as a patient advocate. Could you tell us more about that work and why it's important?
Yeah. So along the way, I visited dozens, if not over 100 different centers, just trying to understand what the latest and greatest in this disease was. And I saw along the way that there's a dire need to bridge the gaps in these various communities, because I was shocked how many times I was the first patient to ever walk into one of these centers and either give a talk or even just interact with some of the researchers. There's so many scientists that I've come across who think that they are studying Parkinson's or think that they're dealing with Parkinson's, when really they're just dealing with cell cultures or mice, and they have very few interactions with the human beings living with these diseases. And I understand the need on some level to maintain a distance, so you can be a little bit more dispassionate about what you're researching, so that you're not biased in any way as well. But there is, I mean, it's a very human phenomenon. It's, as far as we know, it's only ever happens in the wild in humans. A lot about our behavior, a lot about our social interactions go into this disease. And if you don't take the time to try to understand these things, if you don't take the time to try to understand what a patient is going through, I think you're just missing so much of what this disease is. You can't claim to know or be studying this disease even if you don't know what real human beings are experiencing. And that, it hits home every time I see mice, every time I see mice in a lab. You know, 500 genetically engineered mice that live exactly the same lives, they're raised in exactly the same environments, they're bred in exactly the same way, they eat the same food, they do everything the same. No two human beings, even take identical twins, will be able to simulate that experiment. If we were kind of reverse engineering this in some ways and going from the mice to the, instead of trying to recreate what we see in humans and, well, that's actually a weird way of explaining it. But anyways, it's important to know that animal models and the models that we have, they can help us answer very, very specific questions. They're great in helping us understand the fundamental biology. They'll never be able to encapsulate the human experience, and they'll never be able to tell you what Parkinson's does to a person.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah. So, maybe toward that, what will the future bring then, Ben? So three questions: your future with DBS, what steps are next? But then also maybe your personal future or the plans you have and goals you have in your life. And then also the future of Parkinson's disease, research, clinics, big questions.
Been told I need to be patient, that it's probably going to take a while to get the parameters right, that it's probably going to take a while for me to find the right tuning. But if I get to that point, if I get to the stage where they flick a switch and I feel more or less, or at least I experience some benefit, even if it's not everything that we hope it might be, even if it's half of what we think it could be, I don't know what I'm going to do, to be honest. I don't know what my future holds. I'm not planning my future beyond that point, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Because there's so much up in the air. If I go back, if I feel 100% back, I'll never feel 100% back to normal. But if I feel 80%, my future will be different than if I feel 50% back to normal, or if I feel 25% back to normal, or if I feel no benefit at all. Each of those things will bring about a different future for me.
Yeah.
So, and this is something I guess I didn't fully appreciate before the surgery, although I knew it on kind of a philosophical level. I didn't appreciate how much of a fork in the road this is for your entire life. Because depending on the outcome, you're able to do so much more. And that's, like, Parkinson's has taken away from me my ability to be productive in the world, my ability to be completely independent in the world as well. I can't do all the things I want to do right now. If suddenly all those things are given back to me, I don't know what I'm going to do. But I hope to have this. I hope it's a problem I'm going to have. I hope it's something that I'm going to be facing. but I can't see past that moment at this point. I want to experience it. I want to live it. I want to be in that moment. I want to know and see what that feels like. But it's too hard for me to, there's too many variables at play for me to see past it. Now, as for Parkinson's in general, and the future of Parkinson's disease research, I see it as, so I often stand back and look at the field, and I see it, this is going to sound derogatory, but it's not meant to be derogatory. I see it as almost like 100 monkeys sitting at 100 typewriters trying to come up with Shakespeare. Each researcher, each scientist is kind of working on their own thing. There's domains and subdomains of this disease. There's the genetics field. There's the iPS cell culture field. Like there's so many different branches of this of research going on. Many of them are siloed. Many of them are not coordinating with one another. At this point, picking a winner, knowing who's going to emerge, knowing which branch of research is the most promising, knowing which studies are going to be the most promising, it's too hard to do. At the moment, I think we have 150 different molecules in clinical trial at various stages, either for symptomatic benefit or for disease-modifying benefit. I look forward to seeing where this goes. I love to make predictions, but I'm also careful and wary of doing so. But I would say, I can see the biases setting in now. I can see the biases creeping towards these electrical, thinking of the brain more as a byproduct of the electrical inputs that it gets and these feedback loops that exist within it. I think biology is a great subject to study. Chemistry is a great subject to study. But the physics of how the brain works might supersede all of those things. And it might be the more paramount of all of the different branches that we're studying. I know that was a very meandering response to your question. I'm not sure if I actually...
No, it was perfect. Yeah. No, and I agree. There's so much that can be done with things like DBS and thinking more about the general neural implants. It probably will not be truly disease modifying in the end, right? It won't be a cure.
No, I don't think there's any prospect of a cure at any time in the near future, especially because Parkinson's doesn't really exist. There's nothing we can point to in the brain and say, that's Parkinson's disease. It's a clinical label that we give to people. So you can't cure something that doesn't exist. It's almost like trying to prove that there's an invisible spaghetti monster in the room. I don't know if you know that analogy, but...
I know it, yeah. Pastafarians.
Exactly. This won't be a cure, but this might be the best way possible to manage this going forward, especially if the technology continues to improve and we can get those electrodes to the point where they're razor thin and we don't have to have this battery and these wires implanted. I imagine a future in which it's almost like acupuncture therapy in some sense. Another point I want to make, something I'm realizing as we're talking, is my train of thought, my ability to be lucid, my ability to be verbose at this point has changed as well. And I'll be very curious to see if we do this again at some point in the future, how my responses to some of these questions changes over time. Because I'm just noticing as we're talking that my train of thought is different from what it was.
Prior to the surgery?
Yes, prior to the surgery.
And yeah. And what do you think in a good sense or?
Yeah, in a very good sense. It's probably both in a result of the physical changes that I've undergone, but also just the emotional changes, the psychosocial changes. I think, like I said before, it's very much a fork in the road moment, getting DBS and going through the trauma of the surgery as well. And I don't think there's any other way of saying it other than it changes you as an individual. It changes, in some sense, who you are and what you are.
But see, that's what I probably was referring to back before when I asked, was it also liberating in terms of thoughts? And I didn't really mean, you know, that you constantly have your symptoms in mind, but rather that to me, or to others as well, for example, Yuri Bouchaki has mentioned that for him, a thought is a bit like a movement, but it doesn't, you know, then go to your muscles. So it would rather interact within the brain. But, you know, to really have a thought, to have a thought emerge that might be analogous to initiating a movement without the motor output. And we are always so biased in a lot of diseases, including also stroke with language and so on, where our Broca's area as a language area, you know, we see that first, of course, from outside, you see movement, you don't see thoughts. And of course, we have all these instruments and so on, but few people have the insight that you now have to really see the internal world, you know, what changed in your brain beyond movement.
And I've noticed that the machinations, no, machinations is the wrong word, but the way my thinking pattern has changed, it feels subtly different than it did before. Maybe I'm seeing something that's not there. Maybe this is all in my head, as it were.
It is.
Sure. I feel like the same person. I feel like the same. I have the same sense of self. I obviously have all the same memories, all the same things that were there before. But there is like a subtle tweak of something that is there. And I noticed this also the day after the surgery. So I took part in an experiment on the Wednesday thereof, where they gave me a very, very, very minor stimulation and had me do a bunch of memory tests. That was an interesting experience as well, because you wouldn't think that the STN is so intricately involved in memory. But stimulating the STN, I think I didn't see the results of the experiment myself, but I feel like I did better on the memory tests when the stimulation was on versus when it was off.
It does receive input from nearly the whole prefrontal cortex, right? So it is in its entirety, it is involved in a lot of things. So interesting. We'll see, hopefully, if we can repeat this, how things progress. So that's really amazing. Maybe just to wrap up, is there anything else you wanted to cover that we haven't covered yet?
I guess one part of it that I'm a little wary of is the stigma that will be associated with individuals afterwards. That's something I spoke to a little bit about with a friend of mine who had undergone DBS before. But there is a bit of a change in how you're perceived by the rest of the world as well.
Interesting.
And that, whether it be for better or worse, because especially for people for whom the brain is kind of a foreign substance, people who have no knowledge of neuroscience, people who have no understanding of what the brain is doing and how the brain thinks and how the brain works. I think to them, this is not only is it a very scary thing, obviously, but it's very alien. It's very foreign. It's something that they have no connection to. It's something that they can't internalize in any way. They can't, there's just no reference points for what I've been through. I think, and this is maybe, again, me looking too much into these things, but there is a slight change in the way the rest of the world perceives you. Like, yes. It'll be interesting to see over time how to take note of that and to see, I guess, to continue to follow up on that, on that line of thought.
And you mean your direct, like, friendship circle around you, people around you, or do you also think now in your special case, since it's a bit more public, also the public appearance, or both of it?
Yeah, all of it. There's no one that I interact with other than, like, maybe my nephew and niece, who are a little too young to understand anything at this point. There's no one who... Every relationship changes, I feel like. Every connection I have to every other person is a little bit different than it was before. To my parents, to my friends. It's not necessarily good or bad. It's not necessarily, you know, moving away or moving towards. It's just different. It's altered. It's an altered state, I would say.
I mean, it could be that it's also just new to most, and then once they find out you're the same Ben, you know, things get to normal. So that could also happen.
It could be. That's true. And I'm sure it'll change over time as the stimulation starts and as the therapy hopefully sets in.
Great, Ben. So thank you so much once more for participating. This was really unique and very helpful, insightful for me, and I'm also sure to all the listeners.
Thank you. There is one other thing I wanted to say, and that's
sure, of course,
to the patient community as well. especially to patients who, because I have a lot of patients now reaching out to me, asking me how I'm doing, how it was. Some of them are preparing to go through this themselves. I know everyone kind of wants somebody to make some of these big decisions for them, I think. It's a very difficult thing to ask anybody to do for themselves. But you have to, on some level, try to understand what you're going through. And I've noticed in the materials that I've gotten since that there's no patient guide to DBS. There's no good patient guide to DBS. There's no manual that tells you what you're going to go through.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Everything is novel. Everything is kind of new along the way. And you have to be ready for that. You have to be ready for all the ups and all the downs. Yeah. And again, I guess one last thought. I haven't been able to articulate myself as well as I would like during this interview. Not that I'm in any way unhappy with what I've said, but I'll be interested to see, I guess, how I might respond to some of these questions a little bit differently in the future.
I would love to repeat it if you can find the time. Yeah, as we discussed before, so that would be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Super.